You stay here with Tamerzin. It's up to you, but I'd recommend that you follow through on the plan to send reinforcements to the city by sea. Otherwise, your king may have to hold off the Malorians all by himself.
What about Prala?
Tenedra asked. Belgrath scratched at his ear. There's no real point in taking her along. I'm sure that if she stays here, Tamerzin and Oskatat can keep her from blurting out any secrets.
No, my lord Belgarath,
the slender Khan princess said firmly.
I will not stay behind. If his majesty is going to Rakthaha, then so am I. I will not give you my word to remain silent. You have no choice but to take me along, or to kill me.
What's this? Urgot asked, puzzled. Sulk, however, had already guessed. If you want to start running right now, Urgot, I'll try to hold her until you get a good head start.
What are you talking about, Kaldar?
If you're very, very lucky, my brother, Khal Zakath won't get you. But I'm afraid that your chances of escaping this young lady are far more slender. Take my advice and start running right now. Chapter 16. A heavy bank of gray cloud had moved in off of the great western sea, and a stiff offshore breeze tugged at their garments as they mounted their horses in the courtyard of the Drogem.
"You know what to do, Oskatat?"
Urgot asked his seneschal. The big Murko nodded.
"The ships carrying the reinforcements will depart within 2 days, Your Majesty. You have my word on that."
"Good. I'd rather not fight this battle all by myself. Try not to use any more of those warrants than you absolutely have to."
"Trust me."
Oskotat's face creased into a bleak smile. Urgot's quick answering grin was wolfish.
"And look after my mother."
"I have done that for many years without her even being aware of it."
Gravely, the Murgo King leaned down from his saddle and shook hands with his friend. Then he straightened resolutely.
"All right," he said to the officer in charge of the guard detachment. "Let's go."
They clattered out of the courtyard, and Silk drew in beside his brother.
"What was that business about warrants?"
Urgot laughed.
"The generals might want to refuse to obey Oskatat's orders. So I signed warrants for the execution of every one of them, and left them with him to use as he sees fit."
"Oh, clever."
"I should have thought of it years ago."
Urgot looked up at the racing clouds overhead, with his robe flapping in the rising wind.
"I'm not a very good sailor, Keldar. I tend to throw up a lot in rough weather."
Silk laughed. "Oh, then just remember, always to stand at the leeward rail." The murky sky seemed somehow to Geryon to be suited to the bleakness of Rak-Urga. A city so devoid of any kind of beauty seemed unnatural when the sky was clear and the sun shining. Now, however, it squatted under the roiling clouds like some torpid stone toad. The black-robed Murgos in the narrow streets stood aside for their king. Some of them bowed, others stood stony-faced and unbending as the party passed. They rode through a square, and then on down the stone-paved street that led to the temple.
"Captain,"
Urgot called to the officer in the lead,
"have one of your men stop by and tell the Hierarch that we are leaving. He has someone in the temple that he wants to send along with us."
"As your majesty commands," the officer replied.
The cobbled street they were following rounded a corner, and they were able to see into the harbor. It lay in a sheltered bay behind the headland, standing at the narrow mouth of the Gulf of Urga, and was dotted with black-painted Murgo ships. The familiar smell of the meeting of sea and land, a mixture of brine, seaweed, and dead fish, rose to meet Geryon's nostrils, and his blood began to race at the prospect of once again going to sea. The black ship moored at the side of the stone quay onto which they rode was larger than most of the other vessels in the harbor. It was a squat, broad-beamed scow with slanting masts and tarred planking. Silk eyed it distrustfully.
"Do you really call that thing a ship?"
"I warned you about Murgo boats," his brother replied.
There was a brief disagreement about the horses when they reached the ship.
"Totally out of the question, Your Majesty,"
the ship captain, a huge, evil-looking man, declared adamantly.
"I don't carry livestock on board my ship."
He stood towering over his king with a self-important expression, slightly tinged with contempt. Urgot's expression became one of distress.
"I'd say that it's time for another exercise of the royal assertiveness," Silk murmured to him.
Urgot gave him a quick look, then squared his shoulders. He turned back to the hulking ship's master.
"Load those horses on your ship, Captain," he repeated his command in a firmer tone. "I just told you that I don't... Did I say it too fast for you? Listen carefully this time. Put the horses on the boat. If you don't do exactly what I tell you to do, I will have you nailed to the prow of your ship in place of the figurehead. Do we understand each other?"
The captain stepped back, his look of arrogance becoming one of doubt and apprehension.
"Your Majesty..."
"Do it, Captain," Urgot barked. "Now!" The captain drew himself up sharply, saluted, and then turned to his crew.
"You heard the king," he said harshly. "Load those horses."
He stalked away, muttering to himself. "You see," Silk said, "it gets easier every time you do it, doesn't it? All you have to remember is that your commands are not subjects for debate."
"You know,"
Urgot said with a tight grin,
"I could actually get to like that."
The sailors began to push the skittish horses up the narrow gangplanks, and then down a steeply slanting ramp into the hold of the vessel. They had loaded perhaps half of the animals, when Geryon heard the sound of a sullen drum coming from the narrow cobbled street leading down to the quay. A double file of black-robed grolems in polished steel masks marched down the hill toward the water, moving with that peculiar swaying gait Geryon had seen in the temple. Ulgarath took Urgot by the sleeve and drew him out of earshot of his guards and the busy sailors.
"We don't need any surprises here, Urgot, so let's get through the formalities with Agachak as quickly as possible. Tell him that you are going to Rakhtacha to take personal command of the defense of the city. Let's get your Dagashi on board ship and get out of here."
"I don't really have any choice about this, do I?"
"No, not very much at all."
The cadaverous Agachak rode in a litter carried by a dozen grolems. At his side, her head erect, came the scarred priestess, Kabat. Her eyes were ravaged from weeping, and her face was dreadfully pale. The look she directed at Saadi, however, was filled with implacable hatred. Behind Agachak's litter there came a hooded figure that did not walk with the stiff-legged, swaying gait of the grolems in the hierarch's entourage. And Geryon surmised that this man was the mysterious Kabach. He looked at the man curiously, but could not see the face concealed beneath the hood. As the litter reached the gangway, Agachak signaled his bearers to halt.
"Your Majesty,"
he greeted Urgot hollowly, as his litter was lowered to the stones.
"Dread Hierarch,
I received your message. Is the situation in the south as grave as I was led to believe?"
"I'm afraid so, Agachak. I am going to take advantage of the ship to go to Rakhtacha and take personal command."
"You, Your Majesty?"
Agachak looked startled.
"Is that altogether wise?" "Perhaps not, but I am sure I can't do much worse than my generals have done. I have left orders that reinforcements are to be sent to the city by ship." "By ship? A daring innovation, Your Majesty. I'm surprised that your generals agreed to it."
"I did not ask them to agree. I finally realized that their duty to advise me does not give them the authority to order me around."
Agachak looked at him, his eyes thoughtful.
"This is a new side of you, Your Majesty,"
he noted as he stepped out of the litter to stand on the stones of the quay.
"I thought it was time for a change."
It was at that point that Geryon felt a warning tingle, and an oppressive kind of weight that seemed centered just above his ears. He glanced quickly at Poldra, and she nodded. It did not appear to be emanating from the hierarch, who seemed wholly engrossed in his conversation with Urgot. Kabat stood to one side, with her burning eyes fixed balefully on Sadi, but there was no hint of any mounting of her will. The quiet probing was coming from somewhere else.
"We should be able to reach Rakthacha in 5 or 6 days," Urgot was saying to the red-robed hierarch. "As soon as we arrive, I will get Ussa and his people started toward Rakhaga with our Dagashi. They might have to swing south a bit to avoid the Malorian advance, but they won't lose too much time."
"You must be very careful at Rakthacha, Your Majesty. It is not only the fate of Tol Murgos that you carry on your shoulders. It is the fate of the entire world."
"I don't concern myself too much with fate, Agachek. A man whose main concern has always been staying alive for the next hour does not have much time to worry about next year. Where is Kabach?"
The man in the hooded robe stepped out from behind the litter.
"I am here, Your Majesty,"
he said in a deep, resonant voice. There was something familiar about the voice, and a warning prickle ran up between Geryon's shoulder blades.
"Good," Urgot said. "Have you any final instructions for him, Agachek?"
"I have said to him all that needs to be said, Your Majesty."
"Well, that covers everything, then. All right, let's get aboard ship," Urgot said as he looked around.
"Perhaps not just yet, Your Majesty,"
the black-robed Dagashi said to him, stepping forward and pushing back his hood. Geryon suppressed a start of surprise. Although his black beard had been shaved off, there was no question about the man's identity. It was Harrigan.
"There is one last thing Your Majesty should know before we board,"
Harrigan declared in a voice clearly intended to be heard by everyone on the quay.
"Were you aware of the fact that the man with the sword over there is Belgarion of Riva?"
Urgot's eyes went very wide as a ripple of amazement went through the priests and the soldiers standing on the slippery stones of the quay. The Murgo King, however, was quick to recover.
"That's a very interesting thing to suggest, Kabach. I would be interested to know what makes you so sure."
"It's absolute nonsense," Zadi spluttered.
Agachak's sunken eyes were boring into Geryon's face.
"I have seen Belgarion myself," he intoned hollowly. "He was much younger then, but there is a resemblance."
"A resemblance, certainly, Dread Hierarch," Zadi agreed quickly. "But that is all. The young man has been in my service since he was a young boy. I admit that there are some superficial similarities of features, but I can assure you that this most definitely is not Belgarion."
Silk was standing just behind Urgot, and his lips were moving very fast as he whispered to his newfound brother. The Murgo King was a skilled enough politician to control his expression, but his eyes darted nervously this way and that, as he began to realize that he stood at the very center of an incipient explosion. Finally, he cleared his throat.
"You still have not told us what makes you believe that this is Belgarion, Kabach."
"I was in Tol Hunnath some years ago,"
Harrigan shrugged.
"Belgarion was there at the same time, for a funeral, I think. Someone pointed him out to me."
"I think the noble Dagashi is mistaken," Zadi said. "His identification is based entirely on a fleeting glance from a distance. That hardly qualifies as definitive proof. I tell you this is not Belgarion."
"He lies," Harrigan said flatly. "I am of the Dagashi. We are trained observers."
"That raises an interesting point, Agachak,"
Urgot said, his eyes narrowing, as he looked at Harrigan.
"In spite of everything, The Dagashi are still Murgos, and every Murgo alive slashes his face as a blood offering to Torak.
He turned and pointed at two faint, thin white lines on his cheek. The king's scarcely visible scars gave mute evidence that his self-mutilation had been none too fervent.
"Look at our Dagashi there. I don't see a single mark on his face, do you?"
"I was instructed by my elder not to make the customary blood offering," Hurricane said quickly. "He wanted me unmarked, so that I could move around freely in the kingdoms of the West."
"I am sorry, Kabak," Urgot said with heavy skepticism, "but that story does not hold water at all. The blood offering to Torak is part of the rite of passage into manhood. Were you so precocious as a child that your elder decided to make you a spy before you were 10 years old? And even if he had, you would still have been required to go through the rite before you could marry or even enter the temple. The scars may not be on your face, but if you are a Murgo, you have got scars on you someplace. Show us your scars, noble Dagashi. Let us see the proof of your fidelity to Torak and your uncontaminated Murgo blood."
"Dread Hierarch," Zadi said with a thoughtful expression on his face, "this is not the first accusation leveled at one of my servants."
He looked meaningfully at Kabat.
"Is it possible that there is a faction among your Grolems that does not want this mission to succeed? Some group hiding behind false beards?"
"Beard," Silk exclaimed, snapping his fingers. "That's why I couldn't face him. He has shaved off his beard." Urgot turned to look inquiringly at him.
"What are you talking about?"
"Excuse me, Your Majesty," Silk said with exaggerated humility. "I just realized something, and it surprised me. I think I can clarify things here."
"Well, I certainly hope someone can. Go ahead."
"Oh, thank you, Your Majesty."
Silk looked around with a beautifully feigned expression of nervousness.
"I'm an Aelon, Your Majesty," he said as he held up one hand. "Please hear me out," he begged, half of the king and half of the surrounding Murgos. "I am an Aelon, but I'm not a fanatic about it. The way I look at it, there's plenty of room in the world for Aelons and Murgos. Live and let live, I always say. Anyway, last year I hired myself out as a soldier in King Dalgarian's army, the one that he raised to lay siege to the Berkolt at Rehon in northeastern Thrasnia. Well, to make it short, I was present when Dalgarian and his friend from Sundaria, Durnik, I think his name is, captured the court leader, Ulfgar. He had a beard then, but I swear to you that this Kabak is the selfsame man. I ought to know. I helped to carry him into a house after Durnik knocked him senseless."
"What would a Dagashi be doing in Thrasnia?"
Urgot asked with an artfully puzzled expression on his face.
"Oh, he's not a Dagashi, Your Majesty. When King Belgarian and his friends questioned him, it came out that he's a Malorian Grolem. Harrikan, I think his name is."
"Harrikan,"
Agachak said, turning quickly to fix the counterfeit Dagashi with his suddenly smoldering eyes.
"Ridiculous," Harrikan scoffed. "This little weasel is one of Belgarian's servants. He is lying to protect his master."
"Is the name Harrikan in any way significant, Agachak?"
The Hierarch straightened, his eyes intent.
"Harrikan is Irvan's underling," he replied. "And I have heard that he has been seen here in the West."
"I think we've got a problem on our hands then, Agachak. These charges, both of them, are too serious to be ignored. We have got to get the truth here."
The priestess Kabat's eyes were narrowed, and her expression cunning.
"Finding that truth is a simple matter, Your Majesty. My master Agachak is the most powerful sorcerer in all of Skull Murgos. He will have no difficulty in probing the minds of all who are here to find out who is speaking truth and who is lying."
Can you really do that, Agachek?
Agachek shrugged.
It is a simple matter.
Then by all means do it. I am not going on board that scow over there until I find out exactly who my shipmates are going to be.
Agachek took a deep breath and began to draw in his will.
Master,
Agrolum said with a purple satin lining on the hood of his robe, leaping forward with one hand outstretched.
Beware! How dare you!
Kabat shrieked at him, her eyes blazing. The Grolem ignored her.
Master,
he said to Agachek,
there is great danger in what the priestess proposes. Should either of these men be telling the truth, you will be probing the mind of a powerful sorcerer, and your own mind will be totally vulnerable. A single thought could erase your entire consciousness.
Agachek slowly relaxed his will.
Ah, yes,
he murmured.
I had not considered that danger.
He turned to Kavat, catching the brief flicker of disappointment that crossed her face.
How curious that my holy priestess did not think of that before she suggested the probing. Or did you, Kabat? Have you given up the notion of raising a demon to destroy me, then? Will you now fall back on so commonplace a thing as simple deceit? I am terribly disappointed in you, my beloved.
She shrank back, her scar-laced face frightened.
This matter has to be settled, Agachek. I am not going to go near that ship until I find out the truth here. I have not succeeded in staying alive for all of these years by being foolhardy.
The question is largely academic now, anyway,
Agachek replied.
None of these people will be leaving.
Agachek, I have to get to Raktacha immediately.
Then go. I will find another party of slavers and hire another Dagashi.
That could take months. Personally, I am inclined to believe these slavers. Osa has been very honest with me, and the young man over there has none of the bearing of a king. This one who calls himself Kabach, however, is highly suspect. If you were to look along the trail between here and Mount Kasha, I think you might find the real Kabach in a shallow grave someplace. This man, whoever he is, has come very close to forestalling the mission to Rakhaga with his accusation. Would that not be exactly what Irvan would want?
There is a logic in what you say, Your Majesty. But I don't think I want any of them going on board that ship until I find out the truth.
Why not let them settle it for us, then?
I don't follow you.
One of them, possibly both, is a sorcerer. Let them fight each other, and we will see which one tries to destroy the other by sorcery.
Trial? By combat?
Why not? It is a bit antique, but the circumstances here seem to be appropriate.
There is merit in your plan, Your Majesty.
Birgit suddenly grinned.
Why don't we clear a space? We would not want to get singed when these two start hurling thunderbolts at each other.
He came over and took Geryon's arm.
Just stay calm, he whispered. And don't do anything conspicuous. Try to force him to use sorcery.
Then he pushed Geryon forward into the circle that had quickly been formed on the stone quay.
Here is the supposed King of Riva, he said to Agachek. Now, if the ostensible Malorian Grolem will be so good as to step forth, we will find out who has been telling the truth.
I have no sword,
Harrigan said sullenly.
Simplicity in itself. Somebody give him a sword.
Several were offered at once.
I think you are in deep trouble, Harrigan,
Urgot smirked.
If you so much as twitch one finger, you will reveal yourself as a Malorian Grolem, and my soldiers will shoot you full of arrows. On the other hand, if this is really Belgarian, and you do not use sorcery to defend yourself, he will burn you right down into a little pile of cinders. All in all, I think you are in for a very bad afternoon.
Geryon ground his teeth together and began talking fervently to the orb, telling the stone over and over again not to do anything out of the ordinary. Then he steeled himself and reached back over his shoulder. The great blade made a steely hiss as it came out of the scabbard. Harrigan handled his borrowed sword nervously, but the way he held it and his stance clearly indicated that he was a competent swordsman. A sudden anger filled Geryon. This was the man who had been responsible for the attempt on Tenedra's life and for the murder of Brand. He dropped into a half-crouch with iron-gripped sword extended in front of him. Harrigan desperately tried to slap that great blade away with his own sword, and there was a steely ring as the two swords came together. Implacably, Geryon stalked his enemy. His anger was so great that he had even forgotten the reason for the duel. He was no longer interested in an unmasking of Harrigan. All he wanted to do was to kill him. There was a rapid exchange of thrusts and parries, and the entire harbor rang with the steel song of the swords. Step by step, Harrigan retreated. His eyes began to fill with fear. But finally, Geryon lost all patience with fencing. With his eyes ablaze, he seized the hilt of his huge sword in both hands and swung it back over his shoulder. Had he delivered that blow, nothing could have stopped it. Harrigan's cheeks blanched as he looked directly into the face of death.
"Curse you!"
he shouted at Geryon, then flickered and vanished, to reappear briefly at the far end of the quay. He shimmered and swooped away in the form of a swift seahawk.
"That sort of answers the question, doesn't it, Agachak?"
Urgot said quite calmly. Agachak, however, his eyes ablaze with hate, also flashed into the form of a hawk. With two powerful strokes of his pinions, he drove himself into the air, shrieking for blood as he raced after the fleeing Harrigan. Geryon's hands were shaking. He turned and stalked toward Urgot, with a scorching fury rising in his throat. With a great effort he restrained his sudden desire to take hold of the front of the smaller man's doublet and hurl him far out into the harbor.
No, don't be hasty,
Urgot said, backing fearfully away. Geryon spoke from between clenched teeth in a dreadfully quiet voice.
Don't ever do that again.
Naturally not,
Urgot agreed hastily. He stopped, a curious expression suddenly crossing his rat-like face.
"Are you really Belgarian?"
he asked in a hoarse whisper.
"Would you like some proof?"
No, that's quite all right."
Urgot's words came tumbling out. He stepped quickly around the still infuriated Geryon and crossed the quay to where Kabat stood.
"Let us pray that your hierarch succeeds in capturing that impostor. Give him my regards upon his return. I would wait, but I must board ship and depart at once."
"Of course, your majesty,"
she replied in a voice that was nearly a purr.
"I will take charge of these slavers until the hierarch's return."
He stared at her.
"Since the entire purpose of this mission was to convey the Dagashi assassin to Rakhaga, there's no point in their going now, is there? They will have to remain here while we send to Kasha for another Dagashi."
She looked at Tsadi with an unconcealed smirk.
"I will place them under my personal protection."
Urgot looked at her narrowly.
"Holy priestess, to be quite candid about it, I don't think you can be trusted. Your personal enmity toward this Nyssen is painfully obvious, and he's far too important to risk. I don't think that you would be able to restrain yourself once both Agachak and I are gone from Rak-Urga. I think I will just take Ussa and his people with me, just to be on the safe side. When the Dagashi arrives from Mount Kasha, send him along."
Kabat's eyes hardened, and her face grew angry.
"The purpose of this mission to Rakhaka is to fulfill a prophecy, and the fulfillment of prophecy is clearly in the domain of the Church."
Urgot drew in a deep breath. Then he straightened from his usual slouching posture.
"The mission is also a state matter, Holy Priestess. Agachak and I have been cooperating in this affair, and in his absence, I assert the authority of the crown. Ussa and his people will go with me, and you will take your Grolems back to the temple to await the return of your hierarch."
Kabat seemed taken aback by his sudden show of strength. She had obviously expected to brush aside any feeble objections he might raise, but this seemed to be a new Urgot. Her face hardened, and the flame-like scars writhed on her pale cheeks.
So, it appears that our king is finally maturing. I think, however, that you will come to regret your passage into manhood at this particular time. Watch closely, High King of Tol Mergos.
She bent, holding something in her hand, and began to mark symbols on the stones of the quay, symbols that glowed with an unholy light.
Geryon, Silk cried in alarm. Stop her!
But Geryon had also seen the glowing circle Kabat had drawn on the wet stones, and the burning five-pointed star she was inscribing in its center. He recognized the meaning of those symbols immediately. He took a half-step toward Kabat, even as she stepped into the protection of the circle and began muttering words in some unknown language. As fast as he was, however, Polgara was even faster. Kabat, she said sharply, stop! This is forbidden.
Nothing is forbidden to one who has the power,
the priestess replied, her scarred and beautiful face filled with an overwhelming pride.
And who here can prevent me?
Polgara's face grew grim. I can. She raised her hand in a curious lifting gesture, and Geryon felt the surge of her will. The sullen swells washing against the stones of the quay slowly rose until they broke across the top to swirl about the ankles of those who stood there. The burning symbols Kabat had marked on the stones vanished as the water washed over them. The Grolem priestess drew in her breath sharply and stared at Aunt Paul, realization slowly dawning in her eyes.
Who are you?
One who would save your life, Kabat. The punishment for raising demons has always been the same. You might succeed once or twice, or even a few more times. But in the end, the demon will turn on you and tear you to pieces. Not even Torak, in all of his twisted madness, would have dared to step across that line.
But I do dare. Torak is dead, and Agachak is not here to prevent me. No one can stop me.
I can, Kabat. I will not permit you to do this.
And how will you stop me? I have the power.
But mine is greater. Polgara let her cloak fall to the stones at her feet, bent, and removed her shoes. You may have been able to control your demon the first time you raised him, but your control is only temporary. You are no more than the doorway through which he enters this world. As soon as he feels his full strength, he will destroy you, and be loosed upon this world to raven as he chooses. I beg of you, my sister, do not do this. Your life, your very soul, are in deadly peril.
I have no fear, not of my demon and not of you.
Then you are a fool, on both counts.
You challenge me?
If I must. Will you meet me on my own ground, Kabat? Polgara's blue eyes were suddenly like ice, and the white lock at her brow flamed incandescently as she gathered in her will. Once again she raised her hand, and the lead-gray swells again raised obediently to the edge of the quay. With that same dreadful calm, she stepped out onto the surface of the water and stood there, as if what lay under her feet was firm earth. A sudden moan rose from the Grolems as she turned to look at that awe-stricken priestess. "Well, Kabat, will you join me here? Can you join me?" Kabat's scarred face grew ashen, but her eyes clearly showed that she could not refuse Aunt Paul's challenge.
"I will,"
she rasped through her clenched teeth. Then she, too, stepped off of the quay, but floundered awkwardly as she sank to the knees in the dirty waters of the harbor.
"Is it so very difficult for you, then?" Polgara asked her. "If this little thing takes all of your will, how do you imagine that you will have enough power to control a demon? Abandon this desperate plan, Kabat. There is still time to save your own life."
"Never!"
Kabat shrieked, with flecks of froth coming to her lips. With an enormous effort, she lifted herself until she stood on the surface, and laboriously strode out several yards. Then, with her face once again twisted into that overwhelming triumph, She drew the symbols on the face of the water, inscribing them with sooty orange flame. Her voice rose again in the evil incantation of the summoning, rising and falling in its hideous cadences. The red scars on her cheeks seemed to grow pale, then suddenly glowed with a burning white light as she continued to recite the spell.
"Keldar, what is happening?"
Urgot's voice was shrill as he stared at the impossibility that was occurring before his eyes.
"Something very unpleasant," Silk told him.
Kabat's voice had risen to a shriek, and the surface of the harbor suddenly erupted before her in a seething cauldron of steam and fire. Out of the midst of those flames there arose something so hideous that it was beyond comprehension. It was vast and clawed and fanged, but the worst of all were its red glowing eyes.
"Kill her!"
Kabat cried, pointing at Polgara with a trembling hand.
"I command thee to kill this witch!"
The demon looked at the priestess standing safely within the flaming circle of her protective symbols. Then, with the still boiling water surging around his vast trunk, he turned and started toward Polgara. But, with her face still calm, she raised one hand. "Stop!" she commanded, and Geryon felt the enormous jolting force of her will. The demon suddenly howled, his fanged muzzle lifted toward the gray clouds in a sudden agony of frustration.
"I said to kill her!"
Kabat shrieked again. The monster slowly sank into the water, extending his two huge arms just beneath the surface. He began to turn, rotating slowly in that seething water. Faster and faster he spun, while the water sizzled around him. A vortex began to appear around him as he whirled, a sudden maelstrom very nearly as dreadful as the Kerak boar. Kabat howled her triumph, dancing on the surface of the water in an obscene caper, unaware that the flames with which she had drawn her symbols had been suddenly whirled away by the surging vortex. As the spinning waters reached the spot where Polgara stood, she began to be drawn toward the deadly whirlpool and the slivering demon, still whirling in the center.
"Pol!" Durnik shouted. "Look out!"
But it was too late. Caught in that inexorable maelstrom, she was carried around and around, slowly at first, but then faster and faster, as she was pulled in long spirals toward the center. As she neared it, however, she once again raised her hand, and very suddenly she disappeared beneath the surging surface.
"Pol!"
Durnik shouted again, his face suddenly gone deathly white. Struggling to pull off his tunic, he ran toward the edge of the quay. Belgarath, however, his face grimly set, caught the smith's arm.
"Stay out of it, Durnik," he snapped, his voice cracking like a whip.
Durnik struggled with him, trying to pull himself free.
"Let me go," he yelled. "I said not to interfere."
Beyond the edge of the demon-created vortex, a single rose bobbed to the surface. It was a curiously familiar flower, its petals white on the outside, and a deep, blushing crimson in the center. Geryon stared at it, a sudden wild hope springing up in him. At the center of the swirling vortex, the monstrous demon suddenly stopped, his burning eyes filled with bafflement. Without any warning, he rose, arched forward, and plunged headfirst into the seething water.
"Find her!"
the flame-marked Kabat screamed after her enslaved fiend.
"Find her and kill her!"
The leaden waters of the harbor boiled and steamed as the huge demon surged this way and that beneath the surface. Quite suddenly, the movement stopped, and the air and the water grew deadly calm. Kabat, still standing on the water, with the glowing light still illuminating the cruel scars on her cheeks, lifted both arms above her head in a gesture of exultation.
"Die, witch!"
she shouted.
"Feel the fangs of my servant rending your flesh!"
Suddenly, a monstrous scaly claw came up out of the water directly in front of her.
"No!"
she shrieked.
"You cannot!"
Then she looked in horror at the water upon which she stood, realizing at last that her protective symbols had been swept away. She took a faltering step backward, but the huge hand closed on her, its needle-sharp claws biting deep into her body. Her blood spurted, and she screamed with agony, writhing in that awful grasp. Then, With a huge bellow, the demon rose from the depths with his great fanged muzzle agape. He lifted the struggling priestess aloft with a howl of hellish triumph. The Grolems and the Murgo soldiers on the quay broke and fled in terror as the monster started toward them. The single rose that had floated to the surface of the harbor, however, had begun to glow with a strange blue light. It seemed to grow larger as the glow intensified. Then, her face calm, Polgara appeared in the very center of that coruscating incandescence. A few feet to her left, there also appeared a nimbus of flickering light. Before the stunned eyes of those on the quay, the nimbus suddenly coalesced, and there, standing beside Polgara, Geryon saw the glowing form of the god Aldur. "Must it be so, master?" Polgara asked in a voice that clearly revealed her reluctance.
"It must, my daughter," Aldur replied sadly.
Polgara sighed. "Then, so be it, master." She extended her left hand, and the god enclosed it in his. The gathering of her will roared in Geryon's mind like a tornado, and the force of it pushed against him with an awful power. Enclosed in the blue light and linked by their touching hands, Polgara and Aldur stood side by side on the surface of the water, facing the hideous demon who still held the weakly struggling Kabat high in the air. "I abjure thee, creature of darkness," Polgara said in a great voice. "Return to the hell that spawned thee, and nevermore corrupt this world by thy foul presence. Begone, and take with thee the one who summoned thee." She raised her hand, and the force of her will combined with the will of the god Aldur blazed forth from her palm. There was a vast thunderclap as the demon suddenly exploded in a huge ball of fire, and the waters of the harbor geysered up around it. Then he was gone. With him disappeared the priestess, Kabat. When Geryon looked back, Aldur no longer stood at Polgara's side. She turned and slowly walked back across the waves toward the quay. As she approached, Geryon clearly saw that her eyes were filled with anguish. Part 3. The Isle of Verkat. Chapter 17. The barren coast of the Urga Peninsula slid by on their left the following morning, as the Murgo scow beat steadily southward with a good following breeze. Cliffs rose sharply out of the crashing surf, and there was only the scantiest of vegetation to break the monotony of the desolation of rust-colored rock. The autumn sky was a deep, chill blue, but the sun stood far to the north, for winter came early to these extreme southern latitudes. Geryon, as he always did when he was at sea, had risen at the first light of day and gone up on deck. He stood at the rail amidships, half bemused by the sparkle of the morning sun on the waves, and by the steady creak and roll of the vessel under his feet. The slanting door that opened onto the short flight of steps leading down to the aft companionway creaked, and Durnick came out on the deck, bracing himself against the awkward roll of the ship and squinting into the bright sunlight. The smith wore his usual plain brown tunic, and his face was somber. Geryon crossed the deck to his friend's side.
"Is she all right?"
"Well, she's very tired," Durnick replied wearily.
His own nearly exhausted face clearly showed that he had slept very little himself.
"She tossed and fretted for a long time, before she finally went to sleep last night. That was a terrible thing she had to do."
"Did she talk to you about it at all?"
Some. The demon had to be sent back to where he came from. Otherwise he'd have spread horror and death across the whole world. Since Kabat summoned him, he could have used her as a doorway to come into this world any time he wanted to. That's why Kabat had to go with him, to close the doorway."
"Exactly where do they come from? Demons, I mean."
"Well, she didn't say very much about that. But I got the feeling that I really wouldn't want to know about it."
"Is she sleeping now?"
Durnick nodded.
I'm going to go talk with the ship's cook. I want to have something hot for her to eat when she wakes up.
You'd better get some sleep yourself.
Perhaps. But you excuse me, Grin. I don't want to stay away too long. Just in case she wakes up and needs me, you know.
He went on forward toward the ship's galley. Geryon straightened and looked around. The Murgo's sailors worked with fearful looks on their faces. What had taken place the previous afternoon had washed away all traces of the stiff arrogance that usually marked a Murgo's expression, and they all cast frightened, sidelong glances at every one of their passengers, as if expecting them to turn into ogres or sea monsters without any warning. Silk and Urgot had emerged from the companionway door while Geryon and Durnick had been talking, and stood at the rail near the stern, idly watching the bubbling wake tracing its path across the dark green swells, and the white-winged gulls screeching and hovering in a greedy cloud behind them. Geryon moved a bit closer, but did not actually join them.
"Uninviting sort of place," Silk observed, looking at the stark cliffs rising from the sea.
The little man had discarded the shabby clothing he had worn when they had begun this journey, and he now wore a plain, unadorned gray doublet. Urgot grunted morosely. Idly he tossed chunks of stale bread into their wake, watching without much interest as the squawking gulls trailing the ship swooped down to fight over them.
"Gudor, does she do that all the time?"
"Who's that?"
"Golgora." Urgot shuddered. "Does she obliterate everybody who displeases her?"
"No," Silk replied. "Polgara doesn't do that. None of them do. It's not allowed."
"I'm sorry, Gudor. Allowed or not, I know what I saw yesterday."
"Now I talked to Belgarath about it," Silk told him, "and he explained it. Kavat and the demon weren't actually destroyed. They were just sent back to the place where the demon came from. The demon absolutely had to be sent back. Unfortunately, Kavat had to go with him."
"Unfortunately? I didn't feel all that much sympathy for her."
"I don't think you quite understand, Urgot. Killing somebody is one thing, but destroying someone's soul, that's quite something else. That is what has made Polgara miserable. She was forced to condemn Kabat to eternal pain and horror. That is the most terrible thing anybody can be forced to do."
"Who was that who came up out of the water with her?"
"Aldur."
"You're not serious?"
"Oh, yes. I've seen him once or twice. It was Aldur, all right."
"A god? Here? What was he doing?"
"He had to be here. No human, however powerful, can face a demon unaided. When the magicians of the Morindum raise a demon, they always are very careful to set rigid limits on him. Kabat just unleashed hers without any limits at all. Only a god can deal with a demon with that kind of freedom. And since the gods work through us, Polgara had to be involved as well. It was a very tricky business."
Urgot shuddered.
"I don't think I'm going to be able to deal with this."
They stood side by side, leaning on the rail, and looking out at the long waves rolling in off of the great western sea to crash against the barren cliffs. As Geryon looked at the two of them, he wondered how it had been possible for anyone to miss the relationship. Although they were not exactly identical, their features were so much alike that there could be no doubt that they were brothers.
"Gudor," Urgot said finally, "what was our father really like?"
"Oh, he was taller than either of us," Silk replied, "and very distinguished looking. His hair was sort of iron gray, and this nose we've all got made him look more like an eagle than a rat."
"We do look a bit like rodents, don't we?"
Urgot agreed with a brief smile.
"That's not what I meant, though. What was he really like?"
"Polished. He had exquisite manners, and he was very civilized and urbane. I never heard him use a harsh word to anyone."
Silk's face was melancholy.
But he was deceitful, wasn't he?
And what makes you say that?
He did cheat, after all. I am not a product of any sort of lasting fidelity.
You don't exactly understand, Silk disagreed. He looked thoughtfully out of the green swells topped by an occasional whitecap.
For all of his polish, our father was very much an adventurer. He would accept any challenge just for the fun involved. And he had an insatiable wanderlust. He was always looking for something new. I think that when you put the two of those traits together, you might begin to understand exactly why he was attracted to your mother. I visited the palace in Rakoska when Taur Urgos was still alive. His wives were all either closely guarded or kept under lock and key. It was the sort of thing our father would have viewed as a challenge.
Urgot made a sour face.
You're not bolstering my ego very much, Kaldar. I'm here because a Drasnian gentleman liked to pick locks.
Oh, not entirely. I didn't have much chance to talk with your mother about it. But I gather that she and our father were genuinely fond of each other.
Taur Urgos was never fond of anyone. At least our father and your mother were having fun. Maybe that explains my sunny disposition,
Silk sighed. He didn't have too much fun after my mother's illness, though. It put an end to all of the wandering and adventurous.
What kind of illness was it? A pestilence that broke out in Drasnia from time to time. It disfigures its victims horribly. My mother was blinded by its effects, fortunately.
Fortunately?
She could not look into a mirror. Her father stayed by her side for the rest of her life, and never once gave any hint about what he saw whenever he looked at her.
Silk's face was bleak. His jaws were tightly clenched together.
It was the bravest thing I've ever seen any man do.
And it was all the worse, because it went on and on and on until the day he died. He looked away quickly.
Do you suppose we could talk about something else? I'm sorry, Kildar,
Urgot said sympathetically.
I did not mean to open any old wounds.
What was it like growing up in Rakoska? Silk asked after a moment.
Grim. Taur Urgos had begun to show signs of his madness much earlier than was usual in the Urga family. There were all kinds of rituals we had to observe.
I've seen some of them.
Oh, not just the ones in the temple, Kedar. Although there were plenty of those as well. I am talking about his personal peculiarities. No one was ever supposed to stand to his right, and it was worth a man's life to let his shadow fall on the royal person. My brothers and I were taken from our mothers at the age of 7 and set to training, military exercises for the most part, involving a great deal of grunting and swearing. Lapses of any kind were punished with flogging, usually at the supper table.
Oh, that might tend to cool one's appetite.
Oh, it does indeed. I don't even eat supper anymore. Too many unpleasant memories. My brothers and I all started plotting against each other very early. Taur Urgos had many wives and whole platoons of children. Since the crown falls to the eldest surviving son, we all schemed against our older brothers and tried to protect ourselves against the plots of the younger ones. One charming little fellow ran a knife into one of the others when he was 9.
Oh, how precocious, Silk murmured.
Oh, he was indeed. Taur Urgos was delighted, of course. For a time, the little backstabber was his favorite. That made me and my older brothers quite nervous, since it was entirely possible that our insane sire might have seen fit to have us all strangled to make room for the little monster. So we took steps.
Oh?
We caught him alone in the upper floors of the palace one day, and threw him out a window.
Urgot looked somberly out over the long swells, sweeping in off of the great western sea.
From the day we were taken from our mothers, we lived a life of constant fear and senseless brutality. We were supposed to be perfect Murgos, strong, brave, insanely loyal, and absolutely dedicated to Torak. Each of us had a Grolem for a tutor, and we had to listen to hours of gibberish about the god of Engrak every day. It was not what you might call a pleasant childhood.
Tar Urgas never showed any kind of affection.
Not to me, he didn't. I was always the smallest, and he had a great deal of contempt for me. Murgos are supposed to be big and muscular. Even after I'd managed to work my way up to the point where I was his heir apparent, he never had a civil word for me, and he encouraged my younger brothers to try to murder me.
How did you manage to survive?
By my wits. And by using a key I managed to steal.
A key?
To the palace strong room. You would be amazed at how much help a man with unlimited funds at his command can get. Even in Tol Murgos,
Silk shivered.
It is getting definitely chilly out here on this deck. Why don't we go inside and share a flagon of spiced wine?
I don't drink, Galdar.
You don't? Silk sounded amazed.
I need to keep my wits about me. A man with his head stuck in a wine barrel can't see someone creeping up behind him with a knife. No, can he?
Oh, you're quite safe with me, my brother.
I am not safe with anyone, Galdar. Particularly not a brother. Nothing personal, you understand, just the result of a very nervous childhood.
All right, Silk said amiably.
Let's go inside, and you can watch me drink.
I'm very good at it.
I can imagine. You are an Aelon, after all.
Oh, so are you, dear brother, Silk laughed. So are you. Come along, and I'll introduce you to all of the fun that goes with your heritage.
Geryon was on the verge of turning to follow them, but at that moment Belgarath came out onto the deck, stretching and yawning.
Is Paul up yet?
He asked Geryon.
Geryon shook his head. I talked with Durnik a little while ago. He said that she's very tired after what she did yesterday.
Belgarath frowned slightly.
It really shouldn't have tired her all that much. It was spectacular, I'll admit, but hardly exhausting.
I don't think it's that kind of exhaustion, Grandfather. Durnik said she was troubled for about half of the night.
The old man scratched at his beard.
Oh, sometimes I lose sight of the fact that Paul's a woman. She can't seem to put things behind her. Sometimes her compassion gets the better of her.
That's not necessarily a bad trait, Grandfather.
Not for a woman, perhaps.
I seem to remember something that happened in the Fens once,
Geryon told him.
Didn't you sort of go out of your way to do something for Vordai? More or less out of compassion?
Belgarath looked around guiltily.
I thought we agreed that you were not going to mention that.
You know something, Grandfather, Geryon said with a faint smile. You are a fraud. You pretend to be as cold as ice and as hard as rock, but underneath you've got the same emotions as all of the rest of us.
Please, Geryon, don't bandy that about too much.
Does it bother you being human?
Well, not really. But after all, I do sort of have a reputation to maintain.
By late afternoon, the coastline they had been following had grown even more jagged, and the surf boiled and thundered against the rocks. Silk and Urgot came up out of the aft companionway, and Geryon noted that both were a trifle unsteady as they walked.
Hello there, Bell Geryon,
Urgot said expansively.
How would you like to join us?
Galdar and I have decided that we would like to sing for a bit.
Thanks all the same, Geryon replied carefully. But I don't sing very well.
That doesn't matter, old boy. It doesn't matter in the slightest.
I might not be very good at it myself. I can't say for sure because I've never sung a note in my whole life. He giggled suddenly. There's a lot of things I never done before. And I think it might be time that I tried a few.
Tenedra and the Murgo girl, Prala, came up on deck. Instead of her customary black, Prala was dressed in a stunning gown of pale rose, and her jet-black hair was caught in an intricate coil at the nape of her neck.
My ladies,
Urgot greeted them with a formal bow, marred only slightly by an unsteady lurch.
Oh, careful, old boy, Silk said, catching him by the elbow. I don't want to have to fish you out of the sea. You know something, Kaldar,
Urgot said, blinking owlishly.
I don't think I've ever felt quite this good.
He looked at Tenedra and the dark-haired Prala.
You know something else? Those are a couple of awfully pretty girls there. Do you think they might like to sing with us?
We could ask them.
Why don't we?
The pair of them descended on Tenedra and her Murgo companion, imploring them outrageously to join them in song. Prala laughed as the Murgo King lurched forward and back with the roll of the ship.
I think you two are drunk, she declared.
Are we drunk?
Urgot asked Silk, still swaying on his feet.
I certainly hope so, Silk replied. If we aren't, we have wasted a great deal of very good wine. I guess we're drunk then. Now that that's been settled, what shall we sing?
Aelorns,
Tenedra sighed, rolling her eyes skyward. It was raining the following morning when they awoke, a chill drizzle that hissed into the sea and collected to run in heavy droplets down the tarred ropes of the rigging. Polgara joined them for breakfast in the larger cabin at the extreme aft end of the companionway, though she seemed silent and withdrawn. Velvet looked around brightly at the cabin, where stoutly constructed windows, instead of portholes, stretched across the stern and heavy beams holding up a ceiling which was actually the deck above. She looked pointedly at the two conspicuously empty chairs at the breakfast table.
What's become of Prince Kaldar and his wayward royal brother? I think they lingered a little bit too long over their wine cups yesterday,
Tenedra replied, with a slightly malicious smirk.
I'd imagine that they are feeling just a bit delicate this morning. Would you believe that they were singing?
Prala said.
Oh?
Velvet asked.
Were they doing it well?
Prala laughed.
They frightened away the seagulls. I've never heard such a dreadful noise.
Polgara and Durnik had been talking quietly at the far end of the table.
I am perfectly fine, Durnik, she assured him. You go right ahead.
Oh, I don't want to leave you alone, Paul.
I won't be alone, dear. Tenedra, Prala, Lizelle, come here. They'll all be with me. If you don't find out for yourself, you'll wonder about it for the rest of your life and always regret the fact that you passed the opportunity by.
Well, if you're sure, Paul.
I am certain, dear,
she said, laying her hand fondly on his and kissing his cheek. After breakfast, Geryon pulled on a cloak and went out on deck. He stood squinting up into the drizzle for a few minutes, then turned as he heard the companionway door opening behind him. Durnik and Toth emerged with fishing poles in their hands.
"It only stands to reason, Toth," Durnik was saying. "With that much water, there's almost got to be fish."
Toth nodded, then made a peculiar gesture, extending both his arms out as if measuring something.
"I don't quite follow you."
Toth made the gesture again.
Oh, well, I'm sure they wouldn't be all that big, the smith disagreed. Fish don't get that big, do they?
Toth nodded vigorously.
Well, I don't mean to doubt you, Durnik said seriously. I'd have to see that.
Toth shrugged.
"Quite a beautiful morning, isn't it, Geryon?" Durnig said, smiling up at the dripping sky.
Then he went up the three steps to the aft deck, nodded pleasantly to the steersman at the tiller, and made a long, smooth cast out onto the frothy wake. He looked critically at his trailing lure.
"I think we're going to need some weight on the lines to hold them down, don't you?" he said to Toth.
The giant smiled slightly, then nodded his agreement.
"Have Silk and Urquhart managed to get up yet?" Geryon called up to them.
"Huh?"
Durnig replied, his eyes fixed intently on his brightly colored lure bobbing back in the wake.
"I said, are Silk and his brother up yet?"
Yes. I think I heard them stirring around in their cabin. Toth, we're definitely going to need something to weight down these lines."
Belgarth came up on deck just then, his shabby old cloak pulled tightly around his shoulders. He looked sourly out through the drizzle at the half-concealed coast sliding by to the port, and went forward to stand amidships. Geryon joined him there.
"How long do you think it's going to take to get to Verkat, Grandfather?"
"A couple of weeks," the old man replied, "if this weather doesn't get any worse. We are a long way south, and we're coming up on the stormy season."
"There's a faster way, though, isn't there?"
Geryon suggested.
"I don't quite follow you."
"You remember how we got from Jarviksholm to Riva? Couldn't you and I just do it that way? The others could catch up later."
"I don't think we're supposed to. I think the others are supposed to be with us when we catch up with Zandramos."
Geryon suddenly banged his fist on the rail in frustration.
"Supposed to? I don't care about what we're supposed to do. I want my son back. I'm tired of creeping around trying to satisfy all the clever little twists and turns of the prophecy. What's wrong with just ignoring it and going right straight to the point?"
Belgarath's face was calm as he looked out at the rust-colored cliffs half hidden in the gray drizzle.
"I have tried that a few times myself," he admitted. "But it never worked. It usually put me even further behind. I know that you are impatient, Geryon. Sometimes it's hard to accept the idea that following the prophecy is really the fastest way to get where you want to go. But that is the way it always seems to work out." He put his hand on Geryon's shoulder. "It is sort of like digging a well. The water is at the bottom, but you have to start at the top. I don't think anybody has ever had much luck digging a well from the bottom up."
"What's that got to do with it, Grandfather? I don't see any connection at all."
"Maybe you will, if you think about it for a while."
Durnig came running forward. His eyes were wide in stunned amazement, and his hands were shaking.
"What's wrong?" Belgarath asked him. "That was the biggest fish I've ever seen in my life," the smith exclaimed. "He was as big as a horse." "He got away, I take it." "Snap my line on the second jump." Durnick's voice had a peculiar pride in it, and his eyes grew very bright. "He was beautiful, Belgarath. He came up out in the water as if he'd just been shot out of a catapult. He actually walked across the waves on his tail. What a tremendous fish." "And what are you going to do?" "Well, I'm going to catch him, of course. But I'm going to need a stouter line. Maybe even a rope. What a fish! Excuse me."
He hurried toward the bow to talk to the Murgo ship captain about some rope.
Belgarath smiled. "I love that man, Geryon. I really love him."
The door to the aft companionway opened again, and Silk and his brother emerged. Although Geryon was usually the first one on deck, he had noticed that sooner or later during the course of any day, everyone came out to take a turn or two in the bracing sea air. The two weasel-faced men came forward along the rain-slick deck. Neither of them looked particularly well.
"Are we making any headway?" Silk asked. His face was pale and his hands were trembling noticeably.
"Some,"
Belgarath grunted.
"You two slept late this morning."
I think we should have slept longer,
Urgot replied with a mournful look.
I seem to have this small headache in my left eye.
He was sweating profusely, and there was a faintish greenish cast to his skin.
I feel absolutely dreadful. Why didn't you warn me about this, Kaldar?
Oh, I wanted to surprise you.
Is it always like this the next morning?
Oh, usually, Silk admitted. Sometimes it's worse.
Worse? How could it possibly get any worse? Excuse me.
Urgot hurried to the rail and leaned over it, retching noisily.
He's not handling this too well, is he?
Belgarath noted clinically.
It's inexperience, Silk explained.
I honestly believe I'm going to die,
Urgot said weakly, wiping at his mouth with a shaking hand.
Why did you let me drink so much?
Oh, that's a decision a man has to make for himself.
You seemed to be having a good time, Geryon added.
I really wouldn't know. I lost track of several hours. What did I do?
You were singing.
Singing? Me?
Urgot sank onto a bench and dropped his face into his trembling hands.
Oh, dear,
he moaned.
Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear.